Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans, as well as here at Bristol Community FM. This week, Sue Kilrose with us to talk about TTIP at Bristol City Council and the Bristol People's Petition. Also, Jackson Moulding talking about the Bristol Green Capital. He's quite happy to say how much money he's got. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Sue Kilrow. Hi, Sue. Welcome to Dialect. You've been at the council this week, yes. Getting them to talk about TTIP. First of all, what is TTIP?
Well, TTIP stands for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. What it is a new trade deal that's been negotiated between America and Europe.
Now, I get a bit sleepy when people talk about trade deals because how are they actually going to affect me?
They will affect our lives in virtually every way you can possibly think of. This is a huge, far-reaching deal. It's called a trade deal. That sounds quite nice, doesn't it? Trade deals are usually about import and export, about tariffs. And the idea of a free trade deal is to reduce the level of tariffs so that goods can move across borders. Goods are cheaper, stimulates the economy, both in the country where the goods are produced and where they're bought.
Now, just to complicate things, what about things like toxic debt? That is to say, debt that no one is ever going to pay back. Can that move around across borders too?
Well, when the word investment is added into TTIP, which is the P, then financial services, which is the buying and selling of debt, basically. Yes, so that's
toxic
this particular.
Debt. So yeah. The idea, of course, is to get your toxic debt to some other part of the world. If you've managed to stack up a load of, you lend out a load of money that you slowly realise, oh, well, actually no one's going to pay that back. Mm. If you can get that out of the way somewhere and swap it with something else and do a deal, that's good for you, isn't it? So anyway, I am getting off the point a little bit, but
Get back to the point then. This deal is not really about a traditional classical trade deal about import-export. It's a charter for deregulation, and what is anticipated is that all of the countries in the EU and right across all the states in America, that efforts will be made to reduce what are called internal barriers to trade. So that in Europe, that is causing the most strong feeling of fear and anxiety about this deal.
Well, why should anyone worry about that? Because it just sounds that the goods and services will be able to move around much more easily.
Yes, but For all of the years since the Second World War, people right across Europe have fought very hard to create a world in which there was some labour protection, there's environmental protection, there's health and safety protection. Sometimes it's a pain in the butt. But by and large, those regulations are in our interest, and it's been hard work to get them into place. But they do protect us. These are the things that are now being labelled as red tape. That's nasty, horrible red tape. And that they are to be removed because they're internal barriers to trade. So that this isn't so much about import-export. It's about internal barriers to trade. So I can sort of paint a picture of the world that is envisaged by the people who are negotiating this deal. It's that they see America and Europe becoming a huge open trading area where anything that's produced anywhere can be sold to everybody everywhere. And if that good, whether it's food or chemicals or materials, if it meets the regulations in the place where it's produced, the statutory regulations in that place, then it will be accepted as being good enough for everybody everywhere else. So if we had a level playing field where all of the regulations in Europe and America were already similar to each other and the principles on which they were built were the same, then it would be wonderful. But that isn't the case. That we have two totally contradictory systems and philosophies at play. We have a precautionary principle, so anything that's produced in the European Union has got to be shown to be safe before it can be sold. In America, they have what they call the scientific principle, which says that things can be sold and that they don't have to be withdrawn from the market unless somebody shows that they're dangerous or wrong or not good enough.
So it's up to the public to say,
this is harming
me. It might be quite expensive to hire the lawyers and the scientists to do that work, to say, No, this might be dangerous.
Yes. So at the moment, there's an example that maybe would help listeners to understand, which has got to do with meat labelling. So in America, where meat comes from is not available as information for the people who are buying the meat. Whereas in Europe, we get to know where the meats come from, and it's labelled, and that is reassuring for us. The American federal administration attempted to legislate to make meat labelling, and they agreed that it should happen. Yeah, so they were going to change the law, make it required that people could see where meat came from. They were challenged by the beef industry, I think in particular, but the meat producers challenged them. And they said that if the government was to go ahead, they could legislate. That's fine. But they would have to compensate the meat producers for their loss of revenue and profits, and that it would be something like $4 billion per year for 20 years.
Well, I don't believe them. I mean, how much does it cost to put a sticker on a piece of meat saying where it came from? $4 billion?
No, that they anticipate that people will not want to buy the meat that they know has come from feedlots, you know, the particular kind of meat production system that is causing so much anxiety, so that the government has withdrawn the legislation.
In the land of the free.
In the land of the free, the government of America can't afford to do what they think should be done in the interest of the people.
Well, it makes you wonder why we pay our taxes, doesn't it?
So but, the TTIP anyway. Is part of this.
Yeah.
So that's the principle. So the other way around, you know, that we are going to lose gradually. It won't happen overnight. It will be a question of it being eroded. TTIP is, there's nothing in TTIP that will stop governments from legislating. Any local authority like Bristol, that's why we were at the council, is asking them to consider the democratic implications of TTIP. There's nothing in TTIP to stop a city council from making a policy. However, if that policy in any way impedes the current or potential future profits of a big company, a transnational company, for example, then they can sue for compensation.
So tell us what happened at Bristol City Council, okay. The full council meeting then.
All right, so we had the full council meeting and we presented the arguments as to why the council should be more actively in debate about the implications of TTIP, to share their views, to look at the deal. and to talk about it. And we would like them to accept that there are threats to local democracy in this deal, and to join with other cities across Europe and the UK and other local authorities that are already saying that they have sufficient concerns to want to not have this deal. So it's about saying that your city is a TTIP-free zone. So that's what we really want them to do, but they didn't.
Hang on. Yeah, okay. I'm just thinking, well, the Bristol City Council could say that, but then surely at Westminster and Brussels, they may sign this thing and that doesn't really have any effect.
Exactly. So that it isn't to say that you wish to be identified as against the deal as it stands at the moment in principle. That's the end of it. You know, it's just a statement, but it does allow cities to work together. So that cities are big trading blocks, and this is a trade deal. And we have, it's very difficult to fight trade deals because they're negotiated on our behalf by the European Commission, and they are not a democratic body. Celia Malmström, who is the chief executive or the leader of the Trade Commission, has said that she is not doing this on behalf of the European citizens. She's doing it on behalf of European business.
Interesting name, Malmström.
Is she Swedish?
Right. Great name.
I might not have it perfectly pronounced.
No, right. Well, I've just slightly mispronounced it, but I prefer that. Tell us how it would really literally affect local democracy here, because I wonder if you're saying that, I mean, even if it's bylaws being passed, this sort of thing that affects businesses, don't you think that potentially anyway that the council is likely to make changes, do things in its as part of its general work, and then it's really up to the businesses to take the council on legally? I mean, it may be that they don't. It may be they choose that, well, actually what the council's doing here is okay and we agree with it, and it's going to be bad publicity for us if we try and fight them.
Well, I think if it was a sort of straightforward situation, that might be true, but this isn't going to be straightforward. One of the areas in which there's a lot of concern has got to do with public health. At the moment, there are two things that we know are damaging to people's health. One is tobacco and the other is sugar. Okay. So right across the world, there's a movement to try and reduce amount of smoking tobacco intake. So Australia, for example, legislated very carefully, bit by bit. They've always led the anti-smoking campaign, and their most recent attempt was to say that all tobacco products must be sold in plain wrapping. And the outcome of that was good, you know, that they have evidence to show how it's reduced the sales. Then Philip Morris, that's the biggest tobacco company in the world, has attempted to sue Australia for their loss of profit because of the reduction in their sales in Australia. Australia has won the case in Australia, so they weren't. Philip Morris lost that. Then Philip Morris tried again, taking them to a trade tribunal in Singapore. Singapore said they had no jurisdiction. But Philip Morris have not gone away yet. You know, they will try again because they're so big and so rich. They are also suing on the same terms Portugal and four small Central American countries. This Portugal may be able to fight because it's a relatively rich country, but the Central American countries are losing a lot of these cases, so, and may lose this one.
I mean, what you've got there is they're making a calm financial calculation, aren't they? They're saying, well, how much would we have to pay a lawyer, and what is the potential loss of our profits? And if the loss of their profits is 100 times what it would cost a lawyer, then it's a no-brainer. They're going to put a lawyer onto it, and they're going to take the governments to court. Uh-huh. What about the...
And therefore, you know, what happens then is that chills the power and the will of governments and local authorities everywhere else to say, be very careful about...
So the government lawyers will be saying, oh, we can't really do
this. We can't do this because we'll get sued.
You mentioned health there, but I know and I've read that this is likely to affect, if the DIS deal goes through, the National Health Service.
Yes.
So how would it do that?
Well, the National Health Service is a complex beast. I worked 52 years. I'm retired now, but that's my background. We can talk about privatisation of the NHS first. So that's about... TTIP is going to open up procurement for all public services. So that's not just the NHS, but it'll be education, prison services, railways, water, everything.
What about things like the police or army?
Yes, yes.
And the military. Private army?
Yes, yes. But not necessarily. The main doesn't have to make the military, run by a private company, but so many of their contracts. So I understand that there are already huge numbers of private companies providing contracting services to the military and in the NHS at the moment.
I wonder if someone comes along and says, we can fight a war for you at a cheap price, It does make you wonder, doesn't it? But anyway, so get back to the health service.
So, yes, so that our government is privatising the NHS in any case, so that as far as TTIP is concerned, that means that it's going to be very, that there is a lot of discussion about how the NHS will be protected from TTIP. Only the bits of the NHS that are not already privatised can be protected, because anything that's in the private sector already can't be protected. Despite what everybody says, that is the case. There are other countries who, from the outset, protected their health services. Our government has chosen not to do that, though they are talking up the fact that there's going to be some degree of protection. I don't think it's going to work.
Give us a concrete example of how a healthcare company might sue the government in the health service. Over what kind of provision? And if you could just give us an idea of how the TTIP might affect specific services in the NHS in Britain.
Okay. So take, for example, one of the biggest contracts that have already been signed in the NHS, which has got to do with the all of the administrative service that runs our GP services. It's been divided into three huge contracts, and they've all been signed out now. If we had a change of government, and that government decided that they wanted to have a truly national health service, they would have to compensate each one of those three companies. So when the contracts are signed, and then if you want to reverse that, so new government, a new policy wanting to nationalise the NHS again, they would have to compensate each one of those three companies for their current and future profit.
How long does that future profit go on for?
20 years.
Oh, dear. So it's a big incentive not to nationalise things.
So that's being called, there's two words that both actually quite good. One is it chills policy making. And the other is that it creates a ratchet so that you can't go back, so that you can only increase profit privatisation. You can't reduce it.
Now, you've said to me before we started that that TTIP is only one of a group of deals.
Yes.
What other deal? I mean, this is one, but what are the other ones?
Well, there's a deal between Canada, America, and Mexico. NAFTA. It's the first of this family of deals,
What's it called?
North American Trade Treaty, NAFTA.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a deal between Europe and Canada. There's a deal between the Pacific countries and America. And now there's our TTIP, that's America and Europe. And in addition to all of these that are trade deals, there's another deal, which is a trade in services deal, which is going to cover all of the countries. It's something like 36 countries. And that's going to be about, the trade deals are about everything that you can drop on your foot, about the, you know, even if it's a hospital and rather large. But it's about the trade in things, whereas TISA is a trade in services agreement, and that's about insurance and banking and all of those kind of data, so that there's big concern about the management of data in these things. So they'll want the freedom of movement of data across all of these countries.
I bet they do. I mean, I remember looking at the Safe Harbor deal, which has just over the last few months blown up, where the European court has said, hang on a minute, to these big American tech companies, you can't just move data all around the world wherever you want, because some of it is private in a particular part of the world. So this has put a big spanner in the works for them. Now, I imagine this TISA, did you say it's called?
TISA.
Is going to hopefully then reverse that decision to make it much easier to move data around the world, especially our own data.
The final idea is that there should be a commission, a world commission, which will sit at the highest level imaginable. And that countries and things like the European Union, if they're contemplating a legislative change, will have to submit it to this commission to see whether it meets the trade requirements. So the European Union wouldn't be able to legislate unless the Trade Commission agreed that it was going to be acceptable.
Somewhere on a lofty Swiss Alp, somewhere
goodness
where they sit.
Only knows where. It's just sounds like science fiction to me. But I think that we have to pay attention, because this is the plan that's in people's heads, the vision that these, that all of the trade deals are being negotiated really by and in the interest of transnational corporations or really, really big business.
Well, you talked about,
so this is about the people who are the 1%.
Yeah, or the 0.001%.
Yes. So that it's their vision, and they have the money and the power, so they can make their ideas come.
They
to
seem
pass.
To control a lot of our politicians one by one way into another. Now,
certainly
just bring
they control the American.
I mean, I can remember seeing I can remember seeing a piece of film of our MEPs in the European Parliament breaking into a room because apparently that these TTIP deals were being done in secret, and I don't know if they actually had a sledgehammer, crowbar, had to get into the room to try and find out what was going on. Is that really true?
Well, it has now been established that people who have a legitimate right to see the documentation for TTIP can now see it, but it's stitched up in such a way that it's hardly believable, that you have to make an appointment, that the documents are not in an EU building, they're in the American embassy, that when you approach this building, you have to leave your bag outside. You can only take a pencil and a piece of paper.
Can you take your hidden camera in your lapel?
No, you're fleeced. You can't take anybody with you. And we know that, for example, the Pacific Rim TPP has now been published, and it's 35 chapters long, and a chapter can have over 150 pages in. So that our MEPs have got the right to see these documents, but they only get a 40-minute appointment, and they can't take notes, and they can't They can't record in any way.
It doesn't sound very democratic to me. Sounds like the activities of a criminal elite. But anyway, your interesting little scrape with Bristol City Council, the person who's in charge of Bristol, many people say in a dictatorial way, because once we appoint a mayor, that mayor can do pretty much what they want, is George Ferguson. What's his reaction to TTIP, and has he changed his mind at all?
Okay, well, our first approach to the council, and therefore George as well, was November, December. And our letters and our statement provoked a response from him. And in that written response, he said that it was really important and he understood the importance of this deal, but we must wait and until it's published before we take and we have an opinion. And that's exactly what we're fighting against, is the wait and see approach. So we considered that to be a statement of sitting on the fence.
So there's a lot of negotiation going on before the thing is even published.
Yes,
and he's saying that we should wait until all that negotiation is finished. So that's
but he wouldn't express an opinion for or against then. But after we did our presentation and a speaker for each of the political parties that the councillors come from, you know, Labour, Conservative, Greens and the Lib Dems all made a statement about their view on TTIP. He then said that actually he did understand people's concerns and he did think it was very important, and that he would in the meantime be doing everything he possibly could, but he would never, ever take a stand against it completely. So that he is saying that he does not want to declare Bristol a TTIP-free zone. Birmingham has done it. There's 35 authorities across the UK that have done this, and they're endless, really big and important systems, cities in Europe who have. You know, the B's are the group that I think are really interesting for Bristol, is Barcelona, Berlin, Brussels, Bordeaux, Birmingham, Bristol. Why can't Bristol be part of this?
It's marvellous that Brussels, they should know.
It's not just Brussels.
They want to do it.
It's the whole of Belgium. Every municipality in the country has declared against the deal. Every single municipality in Belgium has singly, independently said, we're against this deal. And that's because they believe it's a threat to their local democracy.
What you keep talking about us, we, group. What sort of group have you got?
In Bristol, there is a number of groups, and I'm sort of part of all of them, really, that are fighting TTIP. There's the TTIP-free zone is a project in the UK, right across the UK. And that is actually Global Justice Now. So we have a Global Justice Now group in Bristol that want this to happen. War on Want have been campaigning. They're now campaigning on business against TTIP. Then 38 Degrees has been campaigning. And then there's a small Bristol group called the Greater Bristol Alliance, which is a small group of people whose mission is to work across all of these groups and to help them to work together, because I think everybody agrees that all of these groups have got to work together if they're going to be effective. And they all have the same position on TTIP. And nationally, 38 Degrees, War on Want and Global Justice Now have officially joined their campaigns, both on the broad issues to do with TTIP and on a business against TTIP, which is a new campaign. The Greens, as a political party, are very strongly against TTIP. And they're very much supported by the non-political environmental groups, because there's, you know, there's the whole of the anti-fracking, there's the Greenpeace.
Has anyone from TTIP actually been to Bristol? Because I you know, this is something which is cooked up in smoke-filled rooms in Brussels and elsewhere. It seems to be mostly in a US initiative by US big business. And Brussels. But do any of these people actually come to Bristol to say, hello, everybody, we think TTIP's going to be a good idea?
Oh, yes. Yes, we did. Yes, they've been. You know, the Anglo-American Business Association put on a meeting in Bristol, and it was very well attended. We were there protesting outside.
So you weren't allowed to go in?
Well, some of our members are business people, and they were in, yes. You know, so that we did have people in that meeting
I'm interested to think who around here, I mean, it's interesting to hear this Anglo-American Business Association organising that rather than the European Commission or something. So it's business themselves that are doing this rather than government. But what about the big supporters in this part of the world? What networks, what business networks and individual businesses are pushing this around in the Bristol area?
I'm not the best person to answer that question, because I come from a public service background. And but I have tried to get an understanding of what the Bristol Merchant Venturers have got to say about TTIP. Now, I know that George Ferguson is a long-standing member of this group. And
well, he says he's not anymore, but he seems to be very friendly with them still.
Okay, so he's not now, but he was for many years. And I guess his allegiances are there. And at the moment, with the elections in the air, maybe they will become an important part of his life again. But you know, who are we to say? But there are all sorts of business organisations, and the Conservative Party are very supportive. The other group of people that appear to find it difficult to reject TTIP or to openly discuss the problems with it are the right wing of the Labour Party, so that sort of Blairite neoliberal members of the Labour Party find it very difficult to have an open debate, and they just stonewall. It's good for business, it's good for the country, therefore we will support it. But you have to unpick this deal. It is not necessarily good for all business, you know, and small businesses are likely to do very badly. And the European Commission itself has said that the small and medium-sized businesses will lose, they will certainly lose huge numbers of jobs. The whole thing is only going to increase GDP across Europe by 0.5% between whenever it is and 2027. But it's practically nothing.
It's political power that so concerns me, and I wonder whether, I mean, it seems it's almost like a death knell of democracy. So there's not much point of voting for people if they can't pass laws, because they'll get sued.
Yes, that's the chilling effect. It is chilling. It's truly frightening. You know, it's going to mean, you know, okay, so these people who are promoting this can envisage this business flowing all over the place freely, and there being no internal barriers, therefore low wages, low costs, low standards. But we can envisage exactly what that's going to mean. That's going to mean that our children and grandchildren are not really going to be citizens, they're going to be customers.
Frightening. Anyway,
yes, that's
Sue,
going to be.
I wonder if you could just tell us where the best place, or give us a couple of ideas of where online or in the real world people can kind of follow what's going on with TTIP.
Find out more about TTIP. Well, I think that some of the you know, the War on Want produced some of the best documents, so that you can feed into any search engine, War on Want, and there's John Hillary, who's the chief executive, has podcasts. There's TED Talks that he's been involved with. So that certainly would be a very good place to start. 38 Degrees has got quite a lot of information, but their approach is more superficial. Mm. It's like the headlines. But the War on Want materials have got more depth. And then for people who really want to pursue this at a more academic level, there is a lot of papers being produced now that sort of legal opinion and legal advice, and that's available from the European Citizens Bureau. So that's another source of information. And then for somebody who has a huge ability to read long, long documents in detail, you can now read all of the documents that have been produced for the Pacific deal, TPP, and essentially that ours is going to be like theirs. So that, you know, I'm at the moment trying to get my head around what it's going to mean for the pharmaceutical industries, and that the consequences are going to be, you know, what people are saying is that drugs are going to be much more expensive because the patents, the deals are going to extend the patents on expensive drugs, all drugs, from 3 to 5 years, so that this is the period when the pharmaceutical companies charge premium prices, recouping their research costs. And that at the moment they can only do that for 3 years. Now it's going to be 5 years, so it's essentially doubling. It'll double the cost
of drugs.
I wonder
what this world that's sort of looming on the horizon, that's ruled by these big corporations, what is it going to look like?
Well, in a nutshell, I think that we're going to get more of what we've got at the moment, which is a situation where the economy is creating greater wealth for a smaller and smaller group of people. So TTIP has been designed by and really in the interest of big business, and it's, you know, that that is going to lead to their very, very biggest business doing better and better, and they will make more and more money, and they will drive down costs, they will drive down safety, labour conditions. So we will have more of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer.
And now, what about Mexico?
Okay. So that it is important to look at what happened in Mexico and Canada as a result of the NAFTA, which is the North American trade deal. And what happened there was that it's been monitored, and we know now that the evidence is there. And the new business in Canada was something like 12% of the new business was genuine new business. 80% or thereabouts was business whereby the big companies were buying and shutting down small companies. So that new companies, the sort of, you know, we told the whole time that our economy is dependent on the growth of new business, and small companies are the engine of that, and that TTIP is good for business. How can it be good for business if it actually shuts that engine down? So these big companies will buy small companies to make sure they don't compete with them. They will buy them to get hold of their intellectual property, copyright, patents. That's what they will find attractive in these small companies, and they pick them off. So that's the Canada story. The story that comes out of Mexico has got to do with the closing down of manufacturing units in America itself, and moving them and building industrial parks and towns all along the Mexican side of the border. And so there was a huge shift of people to these factories, where they much cheaper to run than they would have been if they'd stayed in America. They had very little in the way of infrastructure, so there was a lot of social problems in these areas. And it had such a devastatingly bad effect on the economy in Mexico in the short term, that actually the peso crashed, so that it caused a crash. Now, we should pay attention to that, because The euro may be okay because it's such a big block, but the pound is sitting on its own. So that, you know, people, I think we have to pay attention to what might happen to the pound.
Well, it's,
there could be a run on the pound.
So you've given us an amazing sort of complete overview, really, of what's happening with the TTIP. Just remind us again where people can follow it. You know, I think you mentioned War on Want, didn't
you? Yes, yes. War on Want is a good source. The European Bureau is a good source. TTIP, yeah, the transatlantic.
And how to contact local campaigners if people want to?
It's very easy to get in contact with 38 Degrees. There's a local, you know, you can make contact with 38 Degrees Bristol, or you can make contact with 38 Degrees nationally and then come back to Bristol through that.
Okay, Sue Kilrow, thanks very much for taking us through all that. Okay. And let's hope that at some point Bristol says no to TTIP.
Well, I would like Bristol to declare itself. I think we belong with that wonderful list of bees.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, Bristol's in the throes of a lot of controversy to do with Bristol Green Capital. £7 or is it £8 million of our money. No one really sure how it was spent. No one's even really sure whether Bristol is any greener. One thing's for sure, though. George Ferguson's daughter Alice got a grant. Also, some of his friends in the Merchant Venturers. Oh, sorry. George is no longer a Merchant Venturer. Also got grants, large grants of thousands of pounds, a website that cost £250,000 nearly to build as well. So lots of questions about how this money was spent and whether Bristol's in the grip of cronyism, with public money being spent on a bunch of mates down the pub or maybe up at Merchant Venturers Hall. As outside the protest at the end of Bristol Green Capital, I came across one of the people who'd got some money as part of Bristol Green Capital, and he was very happy to explain how much money he'd got as a benefactor. Funnily enough, the Green Capital Bristol 2015 Limited didn't want to say how much money they'd given to whom, but some of the people who got money were quite happy to tell us everything. So here's Jackson Moulding now from Ecomotive.
I'm Jackson Moulding. I'm director of Ecomotive, and I am at the closing ceremony of the Bristol Green Capital Partnership because we are one of the few funded organisations to do one of the strategic projects.
So, did you do some sort of art project which cost £100,000 and lasted for 3 or 4 days and then was thrown away?
That would have been wonderful if we did have that opportunity. Unfortunately, not. We our application was that we wanted to talk about community-led housing because housing is one of the biggest issues around. There's more and more people have been disenfranchised by the idea of even being able to have a home, have a warm space above them to live in. And our Green Capital project was around exploring what people think about housing, and our objective was to try and build a small eco home that would represent how it's possible to have a small home that doesn't cost very much but has lower fuel bills in the future.
Did you manage to do that?
Not yet. We've done lots of designs. We've done lots of...
How much money did you have and what did you end up with at the end of it all?
So we received £50,000. Well, we haven't received all of that. We've received part of that because our biggest hurdle was we've had difficulty negotiating a site, a temporary site, to do the project on.
So it's not going to be anything permanent then?
The physical entity in itself won't be permanently on that site. The home that's built will be a permanent home that someone will be able to live in. And but the money isn't to pay for building that home. It's about sort of reaching out and talking to people about
it. This is what many people have been criticising, is a lot of what Green Capital money has gone into is not building into permanent sustainability into the city. It's all ephemeral. A lot of it's now just gone. It was an event that happened, it's disappeared. Maybe some people got something out of it, a few smiles, but it's all gone now.
Yeah,
and
some of it.
The main reason people are here is that because it's not being properly accounted for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, so there's big questions over the big pot. There's big questions over where all that went. I've got no idea. That's not my remit. We had a very small amount in the bigger picture of it all, and our whole objective was, how do we reach out to people, talk to people about how they can create their own home, talking about self-build, talking about community land trust, talking about co-housing. We've created the local self-build register, which is a mechanism for people to leave their names so they leave their names with the council saying, I would like to build my own place, or I'd like to influence the home I want to have.
I think that'd be half the city actually asking that.
But the main thing is a Mori poll which showed one in seven people would like to build or create their own home in the next 12 months. It's a huge need. Like, people can't afford the homes that are getting built for society, so why can't we put people back in the driving seat? And so our small contribution for this year's Green Capital was to try and start addressing that. We haven't received all of our money yet, but we're still moving forward.
Have you been open about the way your money's been spent?
Well, we haven't been closed about it. I've just told you, asked me how much we got allocated, and I told you, like, I've got no issue about showing what we've only spent a small amount of it because we haven't built the home yet to do all of our outreach around it. So everything's about resource, isn't it? And it's not money, is there's a big question over the money here, but resource across the board for, you know, land is one of the major resources that we're up against as society. People that have got land have got easier routes to things. If you don't have land, you don't have the opportunity to put a roof over your head, then it's much harder to try and cope with all the other kind of things and responsibilities in your life that you need to deal with. So, you know, housing has been picked up by a whole range of fantastic organisations, like Acorn is addressing, trying to deal with like the rental sector. We've got AEOB, which is Association of Empty Office Buildings, that's looking at trying to get people back into existing buildings. We've got the Bristol Community Land Trust, which is looking at how do we try and reduce the financial cost of someone obtaining like a new home or a converted home or another community owned asset. We've got Ecomotive, which is looking at how do we support community led self build organisations. You know, there's the grassroots side of things, which is fantastic, and I would have loved to have seen Bristol 2015 really sow the seed and plant the seed for all these entities to really flourish. And
has it done that?
I haven't seen that happen.
You've had a go anyway, haven't you? At the moment, what we've seen is actually an exploding population of street homeless in the city as well.
And you know, to be fair for us in Ecomotive, is this is the first bit of funding that we've had over about 6 years of voluntary trying to raise this agenda, trying to bring this agenda to central government, trying to raise it with local authorities around the country, and it's the first time that we've had a small bit of finance to help us. So, you know, we were over the moon when we received our small bit. But the bigger picture, where the rest of the money, you know, I have no idea. That's not none of my remit.
Jackson Moulding there from Ecomotive, speaking outside the Colston Hall a few weeks ago, explaining how much money he got from Bristol Green Capital, £50,000. He hasn't had it all yet, but also how he's spending it. And it seems to me what quite a sensible, easy thing to do would be just for the people who got grants just to come forward like Jackson has, so we can put together how much money was spent and where of our money as part of Bristol Green Capital.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Okay.
Finally this week, we hear from the originator of the term sheeple. The sheeple. A lot of people think that this is a David Icke term. Actually, no. It was a term coined by William Cooper. William Cooper's a US talk show host, but more importantly, before that, he was in American naval intelligence during things like the Vietnam War, for example. When he decided to retire to Eager, Arizona, and set up his own radio station, originally just on FM, but then also on shortwave, and he had thousands, then tens of thousands of people right across America and other parts of the world listening to him on shortwave. The Hour of the Time was his show, and here's an extract now from William Cooper.
You don't really understand sometimes what a terrible burden it is to know some of the things that I know and try to wake people up and impart this knowledge to them and find out that they just have walls built in front of them. They want to be slaves, but we're making some chinks in those walls. You too can have a free press, and that's what it's going to take to get this country back without bloodshed. And I'm going to tell you right now, unless we can be successful in creating a real free press where the American people get different viewpoints other than those expressed in the establishment-controlled media, there's going to be a civil war in this country, and it's going to come soon. The only thing that can stop it is by waking up vast amounts of sleeping people. Sheeple is what they are.
William Cooper there from his program, The Hour of the Time. Probably the most notable thing about William was that he predicted the September the 11th attacks 2 months before they happened. In July 2001, he said, America is going to be attacked by Bin Laden, a great big attack on America. He'd realised, I think, that what many see now is that Bin Laden was being set up as a US agent, but he was going to be blamed. And William Cooper sadly died in an assault on his home by the FBI just a couple of months after the September the 11th attacks, just before Christmas 2001. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. And we're on BCFM 93.2 at 12 noon every Tuesday. Thanks to our guests this week, Sue Kilrow, particularly from the Greater Bristol Partnership, and also to Jackson Moulding from Ecomotive. Thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko, wrestling with our new mixer. Not sure if we'll be using that one next week. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org. America number one.
Of a world community and no education to develop such a sense. consolidated, appealing to the people of Britain. Don't support the fascist war started by the U.S. against a poor third world country just to divert attention away from the war they conduct against their own people every single day. Our politicians and entertainers continue to lie to us repeatedly.
Don't believe the hype.
Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last of them tonight, obviously. America number one is the...